Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear oral argument in the consolidated in the consolidated mandamus proceedings. In re Kenneth George and in re Epic Holdings, Inc., Epic Healthcare Group, Inc., and Epic Healthcare Management Company. In these consolidated causes, Justices Enoch, Hankinson, and Gonzalez have voluntarily recused themselves, and because that would leave the prevail, they relate to our needing 5 votes out of 6 justices to prevail, the court, pursuant to its statutory authority, asked the governor to appoint special justices. Governor Perry did so, appointing Chief Justice Tom Ramey, Chief Justice John Casey, and Judge Scott Brister to sit in this case. I will now ask them to come to the front of the courtroom, and I will administer their oath of office for this case, and they will then join the bench.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me, stating your name as well as state your name. I, Thomas R. Phillips, do solemnly swear.
I, Thomas R. Phillips, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute the duties.
I will faithfully execute the duties.
Of the office of justice.
Of the office of justice.
Of the Supreme Court of Texas.
Of the Supreme Court of Texas.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Constitution and laws of the United States.
Constitution and laws of the United States.
And of this state.
And of this state.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
Now the court is ready to hear oral argument from the electorate.
This court, Ms. Marie Yates and Mr. Bobby Rubart will present argument for the relators. The relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Yates will open for the first 7 minutes. Ms. Yates will present the rebuttal.
Thank you. My name is Marie Yates, and I'm here for the relators. The narrow issue,
can you speak up a little bit?
The narrow issue on this mandamus is whether lawyers who are disqualified from working on a case because of a genuine threat that in working on that case they'll end up divulging confidences of a former client, whether those lawyers can pass their work product on to successor counsel. And I need to go back to Epic 1, Your Honors, the mandamus we were here on before.
Dude, really?
Yes, Your Honor, just a minute. You remember in Epic 1 that the old Johnson & Gibb law firm, that's Matter 1, had worked on Matter 1, and this is tab 1 in our poster booklet, Your Honor. The old Johnson & Gibbs law firm had worked on Matter 1, and you remember that last time we called the lawyers at Johnson & Gibbs who actually worked on Matter 1 the red guys. And then the lawyers at Johnson & Gibbs who didn't work on Matter 1 but were there at the firm are the blue guys. And that's Matter 1. That's where they represented my client, Epic. Then the red guys and the blue guys leave Johnson & Gibbs and go form a new law firm, which really two firms because they got together. I'm going to call them one for this purpose. The Jordan McCool Group, and it's got red guys and blue guys in it. And the blue guys proceed to sue my client. Okay, Your Honors hold on Epic 1 in the first mandamus. You hold the red guys clearly could not sue my client. And because the red guys cannot sue my client, the blue guys are precluded from suing my client and the firms are disqualified. Now, why were the blue guys precluded? They were precluded under Rule 109, they were precluded, but the reason for that is your irrebuttable presumption that Your Honors raised in cases like Henderson versus Floyd and Texaco versus Garcia, where you say that if a lawyer in the firm has the confidences, then other lawyers, not talking non-lawyers, other lawyers in the firm are irrebuttably presumed to also have the confidences. And therefore, the blue guys were irrebuttably presumed to have the competences, and that's why they couldn't work on the matter. So the question here is, Robbie, if you'll help me, the question here is, if the blue guys couldn't work on the matter, can the blue guys send their work product over to the new law firm?
Isn't the real problem, though, what is contained in the little suitcase?
Your Honor, that is the question. That is the question.
Because.
And we would say that under cases like the Quark case, which is one of the ones we cite, that what you have to say is that if the blue lawyers themselves couldn't work on it, then the taint necessarily, the confidence is necessarily seeped into the work product.
Do you know what all is contained in the suitcase?
Oh, no, sir, I do not.
Well, let me ask you this. What if one of the items in there are summaries of depositions that were taken? Is there any problem with them shipping that over to the new lawyers?
Your Honor, you've hit on the exact point that's a trouble. The only troublesome issue here is where do you draw the line on what you would let go? To me, it's very clear.
Well, before we get to the line drawing, would you agree that the appropriate test would be the balancing test used by the federal courts?
I do not. I know that the law review articles have written it that way, but I think the dissent in the first Wisconsin case has got it right.
So you think that even deposition summaries should not go?
I think the way a lawyer writes up a deposition summary may very well be impacted by confidences and information that he has previously, and that is work product. And there's two kinds of work product going on in this case, and I think that's where some of the cases get confused. You have work product for evidentiary privilege purposes. It could be core work product. It could be non-core work product, i.e., what is privilege? But we know that confidences for purposes of protection under the ethical rules is more than just what's privileged. The DRs say that. They define confidences as beyond what's privileged, and Your Honors have written that in In Re American Home and in Phoenix Founders.
But it's true that I can't say it's true, but it's a fair presumption that much of what's contained in the work product suitcase is untainted in any respect.
Judge, would you agree with me that it's also true that much of what's in the briefcase is tainted? Core work product, the impressions of the lawyer, his game plan. I mean, one of my partners said it's like saying the blue guys can't coach the game, but they can send their game book over to the new guys.
Well, I can see the argument that if they sent the game book over,
right,
which was
core work product,
focused upon the confidences that they knew that they should not have known,
right,
then that's going to be problematic.
Right.
But I don't see why that should also prohibit the transfer of work that was done. It could involve literally hundreds, if not thousands, of hours of work,
right,
done perhaps even by people other than these lawyers, such as deposition summaries, legal memorandums concerning legal issues in the case that don't touch upon anything that may involve the confidences, just regular.
But, Your Honor, for purposes of the disqualification, we don't go in and draw those kind of lines, do we? We assume that the work, all the work that the blue guys did, is seeped or tainted with the confidence, right? And so if you're going to make
you can't leave a lawyer in for just the purpose of sending a deposition notice, but another lawyer for the purpose of taking the deposition.
Your Honor,
notice.
I absolutely agree with you, and that gets to my point about where do you draw the line. The dissent in First Wisconsin and the court in the Reardon case, I think, suggest a good place to draw the line, which is, first of all, you say, we're only talking about a situation where the disqualification is because of a threat of confidences, okay? This is my tab 2, my pie chart. There are a lot of reasons why lawyers get disqualified, but I'm only in this piece of the pie, the part of the pie where a lawyer is disqualified, the red slice, because of a threat of confidences.
Let me ask you this, though. Court held that the real issue in the first ethic was disparagement of work product,
mm-hmm,
part A1, which had never been written on by this court before.
Yes, sir.
And granted that the discussion does talk about the rest of Rule 109,
yes,
vis-a-vis the presumption of confidence is exchanged, but what disturbs me is, why did you ask for, in the trial court that started this, the prohibition of the new counsel from seeing even the record of the first three-week trial first, to review the order that Judge Tyson made requiring you to turn over privileged and confidential documents as a discovery request, and things like that?
Right. Well, we've abandoned our position on the record, because part of what I would say the rule should be is that if matters are in the public domain, okay, we could have moved to seal that record. We didn't do that. It's in the public domain.
Now,
so
that gets me to the waiver question.
We would also say that, as the chief has pointed out, there's a place where you have to draw the line. The place where you would draw it would be as suggested in the dissent in First Wisconsin and in Riordan. What are the documents that are the bottom line necessary things for the subsequent counsel to understand the case? And in Riordan, they say, that's the pleadings, that would be the deposition notices and the responses. And, you know, we stipulated in this case that they can have the discovery. The related federal court cases, we've stipulated, this is in our opposing counsel's brief, and he's right, we stipulated, let them have the discovery.
But your first position when you were in the trial court was to seal the record of the first trial.
But we came too late to that, Your Honor.
I understand that, and that gets me to the waiver question. Every case that you rely on in this court shows, except for one, that the issue of the work product was litigated at the same time that the disqualification proceeding was going on.
Right.
And in every one of those cases, the issue of no work product being transferred was raised when the first go-round on disqualification. Now, how can you avoid the assertion by the other side that there was waiver?
The Dallas Court of Appeals wrote that, Your Honor, but that's just flat not true.
What?
It is not true that in every one of the cases that
I said every one but one.
Well, Your Honor, we can give you a chart. We've done a chart and divided up the cases.
Second thing, every case that you relied on was decided before 1992 or before in this particular area. So how did you not know what the law was on bringing up a work product claim at the same time of the disqualification hearing?
Well, Your Honor, we're here today because it's not clear whether or not work product would go, but we didn't know that they were for sure going to be disqualified. And furthermore,
doesn't seem to be anybody's concern in all the cases that you've relied on.
Can I just say about the other cases? There is no case. There is no case that holds that you waive this issue of work product.
I didn't say there is.
And furthermore,
but their argument in this case is that shows that you had the opportunity to bring it up then. And should have.
We had the opportunity. In the first Wisconsin case, which is their principal case that they rely on, the party trying to get access to the work product is the one that made the motion. And in fact, if you'll go through those cases and look at them, in about a third of them, the party trying to get access to the work product made the motion. In some of them, the court sua sponte dealt with it in addition to dealing with
it. But in every case except one, it was when the disqualification was going on. The issue was resolved by the trial court on this problem.
Your Honor,
why doesn't that make it a problem for you on their waiver argument?
Because none of those cases are saying that if it hadn't happened that way, it would have been waived. There was no law in Texas at the time that said for sure they couldn't get the work product. That's why I'm here.
Okay.
And in any event, we think, and if I could just answer
it's just a brand new question.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your
Honor. If you were fully trying to protect your client's position, why didn't you seek some type of temporary order about the discussion of this or giving it away to some new lawyer? And why wouldn't it be better to have it resolved so that this case can start moving along to some sort of conclusion? I mean, why shouldn't we find waiver at this juncture, even if there's no precedent?
Well, because we would say that it was unclear whether or not the work product would go anyway, that we should not be required to presume, we should not be required to presume that counsel, if disqualified, would turn over the work product to somebody else.
But first of all, it's the client's. The client owns all these records. And if they're, I mean, the client can get them at any time.
Right.
And if the lawyer is disqualified, the client's got to have some representation very quickly.
Well, that's true.
I mean, that just seems inevitable. If you win, this issue going to be brought to the floor.
But I guess what we would say, Your Honor, is that in a situation like this where it wasn't the clear law to find a knowing intentional relinquishment by my client of a known right on the assumption that we should have presumed that counsel would go around and say, oh, well, we might be disqualified. Let me go give this to somebody
else.
Well,
let's not call it waiver. Let's call it single action or not bringing piecemeal special proceedings. Why isn't there some real benefit to that type of rule for the trial court and for us?
I can see the point on that, Your Honor, but I think to penalize my client when there could not, in my view, have been a knowing intentional relinquishment of a known right when the law was not even written.
Wait a second. The hearing in the record on this, in the trial court on the document Passover lasted a couple of hours.
Yes, sir, it did.
And how, I assume the original disqualification hearing lasted a couple of hours, too.
Yes, sir, it did.
Is there, if you were writing a rule, does it complicate the disqualification hearing to say, and you also, before the judge decides that, have to have a hearing on all whether the documents go or not in the case?
I think you could write that kind of rule, but the rule that I'm suggesting is going to turn on the basis for disqualification. In other words, I'm saying there's not a per se rule. I'm saying that just because somebody's disqualified doesn't mean you turn the work product. You can't turn the work product over. It's only where the disqualification is based on a competence. So if I had one as one of my grounds for disqualification, the competence, I suppose you could write a rule that says if that's one of your grounds, then you better move at the same time. But, of course, I don't know if the judge is going to accept that ground.
Well, let me ask you this, then. What if at the time you raise it, and in this case, after the fact of disqualification, every document that you claimed was confidential or is now in the public domain for one of three reasons. It was filed with the SEC, mm-hmm. It was given to the other side of discovery, or it was introduced at the trial. Mm-hmm. How does that affect
you? I would
say
argument? If it's in the public domain, you could write a rule that says they could have it. What we're really trying to protect here is the core type work. It's the game book. We don't want the blue guys to be able to coach the new team with their game book. That's what we're trying to avoid. But I can't suggest...
In other words, I guess you call it the trial notebook. Is that
right?
What you're...
That's another way to put it, Judge. But I can't suggest to you fairly a rule that says draw the line at evidentiary privileged core work product. Because I know that for purposes...
Well, even if we draw a line, what's the answer to the fact that assuming every document that you say was confidential in the first go-round is in the public domain because it's either SEC filed in the trial or given to them in discovery, and it's not clear from the first epic,
right,
nor clear at all here on what privileged documents Judge Tyson ordered,
right,
and whether y'all challenged that order by,
right,
Judge Tyson.
Right.
Did you challenge that?
No, we tried, I think, on mandamus and failed, Your Honor. But that, you see, now that's the work product from matter one. Okay, Judge Tyson, that gets confusing, and they argue this on the other side, but that's the work product from matter one that we think she erroneously said the blue guys could have. But I'm talking about all the work product in matter two. I'm talking about the blue guys' game book. That's what I'm really trying to avoid.
Okay, but what's the blue guys' game book made up of?
Well, it's
everything that they got.
It's all their strategy. It's in their impressions. It's everything that would be under core work.
And why can't we have the judge review all that in camera?
I'm glad you asked that question. It would be very easy for me to say, just write a rule that lets the judge get in the briefcase and go through it document by document. But I think that's a bad rule for these reasons. First of all, that your cases have said that the party that has the problem about trying to protect its competences is not required to come in and give a list of the competences, okay? And furthermore, so who is going to get with the judge and when he goes in the briefcase and say, Judge, this is what you should look for? It's not going to be my client because I'm not supposed to have to divulge the competences. It's not going to be successor counsel because he doesn't know what they are, presumably.
That's always a problem with an ex parte judicial review.
Right, but normally an ex parte is based on some non-ex parte motions or arguments that are made to the judge. And my point is, who's going to be arguing to the judge on what to take out of the briefcase? You know who it's going to be? The disqualified lawyers.
Well, what about, doesn't the same thing happen when you have a hearing on a privilege objection?
That's true, Your Honor. And if you wanted to limit this rule to core work product, and I thought about suggesting that's the way you write it. That's easy. Judges go in the briefcase all the time to figure out what's work product and what's not. But the problem with that is I think it's inconsistent with the rest of your cases that say that what gets protected under the competences is more than just what's privileged. And frankly, I think that's where the majority of First Wisconsin went off the rails. I think the court...
Counsel, could you explain that theory in a little bit more detail?
I will. I'd love to.
Why discoverable work product that's not core work product,
right,
and therefore presumably does not contain the mental impressions,
right,
and thoughts of the attorneys. Why that is tainted with the competence gained from the prior representation?
I could prepare something like a pleading, and this is where the pleading becomes an issue. I could prepare a pleading, and the reason I write the pleading the way I write it is because of some secret that I know that the former client told me. Now, that pleading is not core work product, but I wouldn't have written that pleading the way I wrote it except for the fact that I've got the secret. I'm just trying to give an example of a situation where the confidences that you're trying to protect are beyond what's privileged under the evidence rules, and that, to me, is the difficulty here.
Let me ask you one final question about a wrinkle in this case. Some of us had a little trouble with the waiver argument in the last case,
right.
As you'll recall.
There was a waiver.
It took us a year or two. And we finally bought your argument, I think, that it was not apparent at first that the counsel was going to have to be disqualified because of the way they structured their arguments. It wasn't at all clear that they were going to be attacking
work product. Yes,
that they weren't going to be attacking what Johnson and Gibbs had done.
Yes, sir.
It was going to be another claim. And then real close to trial, when it became apparent that it was different, that's when your grounds for disqualification came up. If that's true, how about all the records that were generated before this change in strategy, and why should
I'm still going to address that question. That's tab number four, because this is another limitation. This is another limitation that I would suggest on the rule, which is that the work product had to have been created during a time period when the disqualifying situation existed. But what you all wrote in Epic One, when you were talking about was there a waiver in Epic One, you were writing about when did we have notice, or when would the trial judge have had adequate notice that these matters really were substantially related, okay? And the reason I say it like that, Chief, is that the question of attack on work product, and this is tab three, the question of attack on work product is a subset of substantially related. The comments to Rule 109 say that. They flat say, attack on work product, that's really a subset of substantially related. So see, in Epic 1, when you said, when should our side have had notice that they were substantially related? Okay, and when should the judge have been able to tell? And you said, well, that didn't happen until trial, because that's when they attacked the work product. That was a subset of substantially related. That's why the opinion in Epic 1 is written the way it is, which is quoted on tab 3, where we quote part of the opinion. And what did you all write? You said, this is a situation where there's a genuine threat that exists that the lawyers could divulge confidences. So I would argue to Your Honor that attack on work product is part and parcel of substantial relationship. And to answer your question specifically, the waiver point in Epic 1 went to when did our side have notice so that they shouldn't have waived it. When did they have notice of the substantial relationship? And you wrote, not till trial. But that doesn't mean that once we had notice, that the substantial relationship did not exist the whole time. The threat of confidence divulging in this case was from the first time Matter 2 started being worked on. As soon as the red guys went over there and teamed up with the blue guys and the blue guys started working on Matter 2, there's a threat of disclosure. And so I'm glad you asked that, because I was concerned that the waiver analysis in Epic 1 would seep over into this case and confuse the issue of when did the substantial relationship exist for purposes of what I think has to be part of your rule, which is that the disqualifying situation had to have existed when the work product was created. You're not going to just throw out all the work product. You're going to, and some of the cases do that, Your Honor. The Easy Painter case.
I think I have the answer.
They do that. So,
any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you,
my co-counsel was supposed to have some time. Can he have some time? Since I got so many questions.
We didn't have an answer, did we?
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
How much time was he supposed to have?
Well, he was supposed to have 8 minutes, but he'd probably take five.
I think five he'd be here. 5 minutes.
May it please the court. I represent Ken George. With respect to why didn't we ask in the trial court to prevent the transfer of the work files, we did. We asked for such other relief to which we're entitled. The right to prevent the transfer of a file is so bound up with the disqualification. It
well,
is a
with all due respect to that statement, having read the Epic record in depth the first go-round, I don't think I could ever glean that that's what you were asking for, or prayer for relief for such others as may be available, because it certainly doesn't appear in any transcript or any written motion that that's what you were asking.
Your Honor, the consequence of disqualification when a lawyer is presumed to have competences, the consequence is that that work file is imbued with those competences and it can't be transferred. Just like we didn't ask the court to say,
well, then,
don't
why,
let...
If you knew all of that then, why didn't you say it? Instead of leaving it to conjecture in a general prayer for relief?
Your Honor, I don't stand here saying that we knew that then. I don't claim that.
Well, but the other side is standing here saying, under the way these cases develop, you should have brought it up then, and because you didn't do it, you don't get a right to raise it now. Whether you agree with that or not, that's what they're saying.
If the law did exist, that is a consequence of disqualification, then by asking for disqualification, we asked for it. Just as we didn't say, your order was don't let Nicole Smith and don't let Jordan Howard Pennington continue this case. We didn't also say, Your Honors, don't let some of those lawyers leave and create a new firm and bring the case. Your Honors, don't let those lawyers sit on the sidelines and continue to coach in the game, sit back on the second row and tell them what to ask. We didn't ask all of those things either. We didn't waive those things. We get that as a consequence of asking for disqualification. And so the waiver issue is false. It's a false issue.
You agree we're not here talking about pleadings or trial transcript or anything in the public record?
That's right, we're not. They'll get the pleadings, they'll get the depositions, the numerous depositions that have been taken in this case. They'll get everything that's been filed.
What about summaries of, or indices of documents, paralegal summaries of depositions, things that could have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars of non-lawyer but paralegal?
Your Honor, the difference, if you're going to draw a line between core work product and regular work product, you could do that. But there are cases that say, let's don't draw the line. We've got them in our brief. Let's don't draw the line at partner and associate. Let's don't draw the line at partner and case clerk, because case clerk is under the direction of the partner. And so everyone in the firm everyone who works on the matter is presumed to have that confidential information. And so if it's work product, then it can't be transferred. I mean, that's the line that you can draw.
Well, it makes sense to me to draw the line at core work product. Tell us why we should not draw the line there.
The only reason I wouldn't draw it at core is because there's a difference. I think I know the difference between core and non-core, and I think judges do too, but there are going to be fights about that.
Isn't that a much more workable approach, since the judges in the state are familiar with that concept? If we were to adopt an approach that required an in-camera review, that would make it much easier to apply.
That's right. If the rule is that the judge needs to say that core work product can't be transferred, that is a workable rule.
But isn't there a significant amount of core work product that doesn't involve an indulgence of confidences?
No, Your Honor, not under the cases that as they've developed. Because a lawyer, we're talking about the lawyer's mind. A lawyer has got the confidences in his or her mind. Those confidences can't help but seep into the work product. You can't really draw a line between a lawyer and a lawyer's work product.
Well, but in a case that's not, in a disqualification case that's not based upon confidences, there's no problem with turning over work product.
Well, that's right. If it's not...
And this is a very large and complex case, and only a piece of it involves confidences, from my understanding of the case. So what would be wrong with turning over work product that doesn't involve confidences?
That's what Ms. Yates was saying. For example, if the lawyer is a witness or a lawyer had acted as an intermediary, if the lawyer became incompetent, there wouldn't be any problem with the work product here. What we're talking about in this case and what this court found was that there was a genuine threat because of the substantial relationship between the representation in the first instance and the lawsuit against my client, that there's a genuine threat that my client's confidences were being disclosed. And so since the lawyers had that genuine threat, then that went into their work product.
But aren't there issues that involve work product that wouldn't involve confidences? For example, attorney's fees. Couldn't a lawyer do some work on recovery of attorney's fees, internal memorandum, their theory on how they're going to put that case on? What would be wrong with transferring that work product over?
What you've asked the judge to do in that case, then, is to try and look at all the core work product and determine what has confidences in it and what doesn't. And the judge can't be expected to do that because the judge doesn't know my client's confidences. I don't have to reveal my client's confidences. I shouldn't be expected to reveal my client's confidences. And the other side can't argue against it either. I mean, that is why you have the irrebuttable presumption. You don't put the burden on me to go to the disqualified lawyers and say, these are the confidences you have, and that's why you should be disqualified. There's an irrebuttable presumption that they've got them. And I'm saying now, if they've got them, if they're in their mental processes, then that is what work product is. It's the fruit of those mental processes.
But that presumption doesn't exist until you show substantial relationship or some other part of 109.
You're exactly right. Substantial relationship has to exist.
It's not out there first and then you find something else.
That's right.
And you get the benefit of that presumption for the very reason you just said, that you shouldn't have to reveal those competences in getting a lawyer disqualified.
That's right. And just like we couldn't go and say the McCool-Smith lawyers had the following competences and that's why they should be disqualified, we shouldn't be required to go and say they have it in their work product.
Now, I'm a little confused. What is your viewpoint about when the rationale for your motion to disqualify the two firms arose vis-a-vis disparagement of work product? As I understand, Ms. Yates, she and her client didn't know about it until the trial started. You're there too?
That's when we saw it. I was there, we raised the motion during trial.
I understand. Okay.
And that was the first time we saw it.
So would it be then, under the argument made by Ms. Yates, you have a cutoff date, that anything that was produced before y'all realized that was a work product problem would not be covered under your request of no transfer for work product to the new firm?
The issue is not when we discovered the conflict, but when the conflict existed. In this case, since the court said that the cases were substantially related, it was there all the time. And so everything.
Well, then under that statement, y'all knew about it in September of 1994, as I recall, because that's when you and the co-counsel first brought this to the attention of the two firms, didn't you?
And the court disagreed.
So you had knowledge the whole time.
And the court disagreed, and this court agreed that there was no waiver. It wasn't obvious at that time.
No, they just agreed there was no waiver of your right to file a disqualification motion, not that it wasn't there.
All I'm saying is that the time when you determine what work product can be transferred and what work product can't is when the firm is laboring under the taint. Whenever the firm is disqualified, that work which is created during that time period ought not be transferred. If there is a time period where a firm did a lot of work, 2-3 years of work, and then a tainted lawyer comes over to them, and that firm then is disqualified, the work that they did for 2 or 3 years, that's okay. You can transfer that. Only that work that was done while they labor under the disqualification. That is tainted irrebuttably as a matter of law.
But in this case, there was no... It was at the June trial that you determined that there was grounds for disqualification. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, that is when we were alerted. They are attacking the work product. These cases are indeed substantially related, as we'd argued earlier, but was rejected.
And from that date, in June 1994, thereafter, you knew that there were grounds for disqualification. Is that right?
We moved for it and lost that. So, no, and as this court found, if you look at Epic One, we didn't know if there were grounds. No one knew. There was nothing in the pleadings or in the discovery that said that we were on notice that there was a conflict.
But you had filed motions before you raised the work product claim, which Judge Tyson overruled. And your whole pitch in Epic One was the appearance of the work product disparagement portion of 109A1 didn't come to the fore until the trial was in progress, and we refiled our motions based on that ground. So in answer to Chief Justice Ramey's question, I think I'm a little confused. You knew from September of 94 there were grounds for disqualification, either because of competences or, as you later learned, work product disparagement.
And I
don't disagree with you that the court, when it wrote Epic One, said that, no, you did not waive your right to bring the disqualification claim. But the question I'm raising is, under the way you posit a possible rule, the work product is not out of the box for anything that happened before you realized the ground for which you're raising your claim.
Your Honor, if we have, there are already principles in place for the problem that you're raising. If we knew of grounds for disqualification mm-hmm. and we sat, we played games and didn't bring them, then we would have waived it. We would have waived it all. In this case, we brought a motion to disqualify as soon as we thought there was a reason to move. The trial court overruled that. So if you say that by doing that, we've waived our right to complain, then what you've said is we have to, as a matter of law, mandamus decisions denying disqualification motions. That's what you said. You said if you don't mandamus it, you've waived it. And this court
No, I'm not saying that. I'm trying to get you to answer me in connection with the rule that you want to say. When is the effective date of the cutoff for work product that can or can't be transferred because of a disqualification order? And there was some suggestion by Ms. Yates that, well, under one of the cases that y'all rely on, anything before the tainted lawyer gets involved on the issue that you've raised for disqualification is okay to pass on. And anything under the ground that you've raised that the lawyer's involved with from that point on is not passed on. And so what I'm trying to figure out here under the facts of this case and the protracted litigation, if you first had the opportunity to raise disparagement of work product in June of 1995 or six, whichever year it was, why is it every piece of work product before that date transferable?
Because in this case, Your Honor, this court has already found that the prior representation of my client and the prosecution of this suit are substantially related. And because
I understand, we could have found that in September of 94 if you had filed a disqualification.
But, well, we did. But the because they were substantially related from the get-go, from the beginning, everything is tainted. If the disqualification event comes up later, after the case has begun, then that's the target. Is where when does the disqualifying event...
So then is it your viewpoint that the qualification event is not the one that you based your June 96 motion on when the trial aborted?
That's the difference. When there's a difference between when we had notice to bring the disqualification motion and when we had enough evidence to have them disqualified. There's a difference between when we had notice and when we bring the motion and when the court finds it, than when the disqualification event actually occurred. And it occurred from the beginning of the representation.
Let's put it this way. When did you realize the work product could be tainted?
There was a motion before I was ever involved in the case. That's what I'm saying. They moved to disqualify opposing counsel.
Give me a month and year. When did you realize the work product could be tainted?
You're talking about my mind? When
did any lawyer with regard to your side of the case realize that the work product could be tainted?
When this court ruled that the two were substantially related.
So you didn't, when you filed the motion for disqualification, you had no idea that the work product that these lawyers who tainted the whole case, that their work product may be tainted.
We were not familiar with the theory that we're arguing.
When did you realize that the work product could be tainted?
When we did research after this court ruled.
Well, let me ask you, how can you tell us here today that you knew about, that you included that in your prayer for such other further relief as may be appropriate?
That's what I tried to say. It was not in our mind. But if you want to say that that was the law, then we asked for it by such other relief. Look, we didn't think of it until this court ruled.
My next question is,
I think that's the problem. The fact of the matter is you just didn't think of it before now.
That's right. But that doesn't change the fact that either the work product should be transferred or it shouldn't. And if a consequence of being disqualified under 109 is that the work product is tainted and shouldn't be transferred, then when you ask for someone to be disqualified, you've asked for it. as I said earlier, we didn't list every conceivable consequence of the disqualification, that the disqualified lawyers can't sit at the table. We didn't ask for that. You waived it. That the disqualified lawyers can't reconstitute as a new law firm. You didn't ask for that. You waived it. That the disqualified lawyers can't, whatever. I mean, I could go on and on. We didn't ask for every single conceivable consequence of disqualification. No, we didn't lay it out in a prayer of 300 things. And if we listed 300 things, we would have left something out.
Any other questions? Thank you. The court is ready. Your argument and respond.
Okay, please, the court, Mr. Jim Hartman, will present argument for the response.
Okay, please, the court, counsel. This is a waiver case. That's what you need to decide today. And I am walking, talking, living proof that that's all this case is, because I stand before you almost totally ignorant of everything that's gone on in the past. Why? Because counsel for the relators have threatened me with disqualification if I look at the record, if I look at, talk to McCool Smith, if I look at the documents that Judge Tyson ordered disclosed. I made the mistake of doing what any citizen in the country could do. I went down, paid my $10,000 to the court reporter, and got a copy of the record.
Well, they really have waived that one now. So let's go on to the issue. Certainly, disqualified counsel, once they're disqualified, that doesn't give them carte blanche to pass on confidences to new counsel, right?
Well, I think it does, to the extent it's in their file.
So once they're disqualified, they just write a memo to the file before they hand it over to you. By the way, make sure you ask them about this stuff that we remember from back in 1990, because this one will really embarrass them.
I don't agree with that.
Of course not.
Because that's work done after the disqualification.
So the first time, so we would expect disqualified counsel exercising their professional duties not to turn over part of the file to you.
No, I would expect them to turn over the entire file to the client.
Even if they know there's confidences in there, it's been so found, you'd expect them to turn that over.
I think they're required to. I think the case law requires that, and I think the disciplinary rule requires that. It's in the chart. The disciplinary rule is set forth in tab 5
if the purpose of the disqualification is to protect the confidences, what sense would that make?
Well, at that point, I mean, we have that problem every day, Justice O'Neill, with lawyers who are changing positions, who get involved in a case, and they get disqualified.
Well, there are different bases for disqualification. If the basis for the disqualification is the revealing of confidences, then what sense would it make to just turn the file over and allow the confidences to be revealed another way? I mean, can you give any credit to their balancing approach?
Well,
or are you taking an absolute position?
I think, like in everything, when you get down to it, there are going to be exceptions that require balancing tests. And I think that's what First Wisconsin concluded. And I think the rule that I believe this court has made in the disciplinary rules is crystal clear. Has to be turned over and cannot be retained, it can be retained only if it will not be prejudicial to the client. I mean, it's a direct mandate.
Where would you draw the line? Your opposing counsel doesn't want in-camera review. If you backed off the absolute position that it's all capable of being turned over, where would you draw the line in terms of how you ferret out the work product that's based on the confidential information?
I think it has to be pretty much what's set forth in First Wisconsin, frankly, and that is a case-by-case determination. You have to show the specific confidences and the work that's specifically infected.
But you have to review your confidences to keep them protected. That's not much of a protection.
Well, but at that point, I think that's all we can do, because the cat is out of the bag, so to speak.
If enough lawyers mess up a client's life, it's just too bad.
Well, they do have a remedy. They have a remedy they exercised in this case, and that's to sue the lawyers, which they did. And it's unfortunate, but it's really not much different than any lawyer who breaches a duty to his client by revealing the confidences anyway. If a lawyer gets on the TV and reveals all of his client's confidences, what do you do at that point?
We don't let the other side use it.
How do you stop it? How can you say they're not being used? They're used in secret. I mean, they're going to be used because they're in our minds. Just like in this case, to the extent the confidences that are there, and I don't really believe there are any, but to the extent they're there and shared with my client, what do? We muzzle my client
to keep her from talking to me about something that she read that the Goldsmith gave her,
sure,
or something
they
told her?
You do that with the fruit of the poisonous tree all the time in criminal cases. All the time.
Well,
we say you can't use that in this trial. We're not going to tell the jury that. Anybody on the jury that's heard it is disqualified.
Well, I don't. I just don't see that working in a situation in like this, where in particular, where we're dealing with a breach of fiduciary by these people, and we've got all these confidential records that are ordered disclosed anyway. I mean, what I don't understand really what the relators are talking about, because they focus on the work product in matter two. But the problem with the work product in matter two is it's based on the work product in matter one. And it sounded like in their argument and with some of the questions and answers that somebody was suggesting that they're not objecting to the work product in matter one being revealed. But they are. Ms. Yates said, we're not, the discovery products and so forth, we're not objecting to that. But in their supplemental brief filed in this court just a month ago, they said that what Judge Tyson ordered was to turn over documents. Documents are work product, and to the extent those documents have not found their way into the public domain, I shouldn't get to see them. So they're still saying that even though Judge Tyson has ruled and said, get these documents, that I'm not supposed to see them. What they're talking about is, unless it was an exhibit at trial or talked about in trial, I can't see it. That's the bottom line here. But what about the work product that Judge Tyson turned over? Doesn't that contain the confidences that they're saying shouldn't be disclosed? Probably does, but you know what? I don't know because I can't see it. That's why there's a waiver. McCool Smith is the firm that should have been addressing this issue to this court or to any other court.
Well, what are
back in the disqualification?
If they're the only ones talking, and the question is, did you turn over confidential information, breach your fiduciary duty to your client, what are they going to say about 100% of the file they're turning over? Are they going to fall on their swords and say, well, you're right, that part we turned over, we breached our fiduciary duty when we did that? I'm going to say, not to pick on McCool Smith, but everybody who's disqualified is going to say, of course we didn't ever disclose any confidences, right?
Well,
that's not, how is that going to help me as a trial judge to have them ban 100% of it's okay, Judge?
If you do the balancing test that's set forth in First Wisconsin and you have some kind of review, McCool Smith is the party that can explain where the information came from. They can show the link to, for example, this work product in matter one that's been injected into matter two.
And 100% of the time, the people in McCool Smith's position will say, we got it independently.
Well, they may. Maybe they have to show it. I
don't
know.
Because otherwise they lose their bar license if they say something else, right?
Well, or they get sued is what, like what happened here. But it's a thorny dilemma. But I don't think the court should deal with it on these facts. And the primary reason I don't think the court should deal with it is because Judge Tyson ordered all this confidential information delivered to my client. And so, consequently, I think the court has to wonder, well, aren't these confidences already out there anyway? And so I think what the court should look at is the waiver issue, number one, and the mootness issue. I think it's waived because they waited. I mean, the idea that let me throw something else out there. Maybe when they came to this court on their, I don't know, sixth attempt before a judicial body to get a disqualification, maybe they thought they shouldn't ask for that bar because they thought it would make it more difficult for them to get the relief they wanted. So maybe they intentionally did that. I don't know. I don't know what was done earlier. There was a mandamus of Judge Tyson's order. I don't know whether it reached this court or not. I don't have any idea.
Would you explain your moot statement? I don't believe you.
I think it's moot because Judge Tyson ordered the delivery, presumably, of all confidential information under the Garner versus Wolfenberger standard. And so,
well, it's really not clear whether they're asking this court in this mandamus to review Judge Tyson's order, even though they asked the trial court to do it.
Well, that's it's effectively what they did in the reply brief, Justice Baker, when they said...
Well, I understand it, but there's not one shred of anything about that order or the mandamuses in this record that I know of.
That's correct, because what the plan is here is to get this court to say, well, there's got to be some kind of prohibition, and then we're going to go back and we're going to fight it all over again and spend another year where they take the position that this stuff I'm not supposed to get.
All right, so is it your secondary argument today that it's moot because you could speculate that everything that Judge Tyson required them to turn over, for which there's no indication in the record that that order was set aside, and that all those documents are all the documents that they assert include the competencies.
Well,
is that why it's moot, because it's all public now?
It's not public, but that's why I believe it's moot.
In other words, McCool et al. Have it.
Yeah, any good lawyer should have been able to get the same information. And I think if you look at the underlying case, and Garner v. Wolfenbarg, I really haven't looked at it in a long time, but basically my recollection is it's a case where you've got a derivative shareholder, and they say that the corporation cannot use the attorney-client privilege in connection with the transaction that's complained about to prevent information from going to the shareholder who's attacking it. Well, if that's true, then there are no confidences that could be asserted against my client. If the Garner versus Wolfenbarger case was accurately applied by Judge Tyson, then there are no confidences, period. I think that Judge Tyson's ruling was mandamus. I think I said that in my documents. I don't know, because it's a little hard for me to find out there have been so many mandamus proceedings, and frankly, what I do is chilled by the threats that I get.
Idea that there wasn't any confidential information obtained or any threat of it, that's contrary to our writing in the last opinion, isn't it?
Well, I think, Justice Heck, if you're talking about the fact that you presume that there was confidential information, I agree with that, but I don't think anybody addressed the issue of whether Judge Tyson ordered all of this turned over. And I don't know what Judge Tyson ordered turned over, because all I got is a copy of the order that I pulled out of the court's file, and it's, you know, 80 volumes or something like that. But I've attached it to the record. It's part of my appendix. And it refers to privileged communications of Johnson and Swanson, or Johnson and Gibbons. And so what I'm really getting at is, if you look at the underlying case and you look at that order, I don't think there can be any confidence. There's kind of a side argument here that I can't really address fully, but the court, I think, has looked at it before.
Well, stop. Why can't there be any confidence?
Because I think Judge Tyson essentially ordered them turned over,
well,
to the extent they're reduced to writing.
In the face of that argument, our court has held that when you have the elements of a substantial relationship and the client represented by the same counsel, and it's an adverse situation, you get the benefit of an irrebuttable presumption that competences were exchanged and that they were shared with the new firm. So regardless of what Judge Tyson ordered turned over, that's what the law is. That's what Judge Heck refers to. That's there. You can't say they're not anymore. But the next question is there some other way that even though that's there because of subsequent developments, they're no longer confidential pieces of paper, or they're no longer confidential whatevers?
Not against my client. They're not confidential, and I think that's basically what Garner is all about. And I'm agreeing that the court is forced to conclude that there were confidential.
But you see, their theory is, despite all that, even though you're brand new and they couldn't disqualify you as a new lawyer under 109 because you didn't represent anybody before, you're brand new. But their theory is what was done and what you're going to get was done by the people who were disqualified because there were competences presumed in this exchange. And you shouldn't get the benefit of those competences that are presumed to be there with this work product. And so the question is, why should you get them? And if there are reasons why not, why you should get them, is it the waiver issue and the mootness issue?
I think I should get them for three reasons: the waiver issue, the mootness issue, and the third reason is it's my client's file. And that's it, and that's the law. And it comes to me.
Now, there's some argument back and forth about who has to show harm if it's turned over, or who has to show harm if it's not turned over. I haven't read the transcript of the hearing. Did you show any harm to your client, Ms. Anderson, if you don't get the work product that we can find in the record?
I really don't recall whether I showed any harm by any testimony. I did testify. I believe that we showed harm in our argument. I mean, let me give you some examples of why I think my client would be harmed. This case was vigorously contested, and it was basically tried for 3 weeks or 2 or 3 weeks. There are all kinds of hearings, all kinds of arguments. If I don't get the notes of McCool Smith relating to all of that, then they have the benefit of a dry run.
You've got the transcript, don't you?
I have the transcript of the trial.
Why do you need tainted counsel's own personal notes and thoughts about that trial?
Well, just because of their analysis of what was said. If somebody said something that was wrong. Let me give you a better example. The trial notes, all right? Something played terribly in front of the jury, just as an example. McCool Smith put some testimony on. It played very poorly against the jury. Their side knows it.
Or the jury consultant's notes.
They don't want me to get the jury consultant's notes. That's one of the things that is in their initial ban. And I think if you ask them, can I get the jury consultant's notes? And by the way, expert reports. Under their view, I have to get brand new experts and start over again because these experts have been presumptively infected by these confidences. But now Epic and Mr. George know that something didn't play well in front of the jury. So they're going to be trying to get it in. I'm not going to know to try and keep it out. Why do they know? Because they were there. Why do I not know? Because McCool Smith was there, and through their efforts,
but what
I don't
McCool
get the notes.
Smith's notes say, remind me next time to use that document that I or my law partner drafted back when we represented Epic or Johnson & Gibbs, Epic or Mr. George.
I think I should be able to get that because that document, I believe, I'm almost sure, is in Judge Tyson's
But not his thoughts documents. About it.
Well, not his thoughts about it, but I don't know why his thoughts about that document would be a problem at this stage. Because really what they're complaining about is not what the McCool Smith lawyers were thinking of as they tried the case. It's what they were thinking of as affected or infected by what they did in Matter 1. And in this case, we don't have the lawyers from Matter 1. It's not a side-switching case like they like to say it is. We've got lawyers in another firm. It's presumed that the information comes over. I agree with that, and I think that's the standard the court has to adopt.
But we found in the first case, or concluded in the first case, that there was an attack on their former law firm's work product.
Well, I agree with that.
And you now say you get his notes that, let's say, theoretically reflect that very same attack on the work product. The blueprint, map it out, how you use that information to make the attack.
I certainly think I should. My assessment...
So what's the point of disqualifying McCool if you get everything that he knew?
Well, I think the disqualification by the court, and I don't know what was in the majority's mind, or much less Justice Hex, who I believe wrote the opinion.
We tried to put it on the page.
That's all we did. But nevertheless, it's the disparagement that mandated the disqualification in my book, not the information that they had. It's the fact, it's the unseemliness of a lawyer standing in front of a jury and attacking something that his prior firm did.
Well, but when we disqualify judges, we wipe out everything they did. It's tremendous waste. It's expensive. We have to do it all over again. But the appearance of a disqualified judge with a financial interest in the case, we deem sufficient for to say, sorry, we have to start all over again. Now, that's been the rule for judges for 100 years, if the judge is disqualified. Should we change that rule, too, in your opinion, or is that different from disqualifying lawyers?
Well, I think it's different, and one reason why I think it's different is because, frankly, I believe judges are held to a higher standard even than I am.
Than lawyers?
Than other lawyers. But I'm first to say that this is a tough issue. And in the right case, I wouldn't want to have to struggle with it if I were the court. This is not the case. And the reason this is not the case is because none of us know what Judge Tyson ordered turned over. Maybe Judge Tyson ordered all the notes to be turned over of every meeting between these lawyers and at Johnson & Gibbs when they formulated the company, and between Mr. George. And if that's the case, there are no confidences. This is a waiver case. It can be resolved simply on waiver. It should have been resolved, I think, 2 years ago.
Let me ask you, is your argument for the waiver based on the supposition that Judge Tyson's order in discovery wiped out the confidentiality aspect of the case?
No, sir.
Or is your waiver argument is that they should have filed at the same time of the disqualification hearing a specific pleading asking for the work product to be withheld?
The second. They should have asked for it so that I didn't have to come in here in the dark and try and defend my client.
Would you expect the judge to hold that hearing at that time, or is it just a matter you have to file the pleading? I mean, it seems to me it'd be a tremendous waste of time to go through several hours of disqualification, and then the judge says, I'm taking it under advisement, say, okay, judge, we don't want to waive about the documents, so assuming you disqualify them, we need to go forward with a two-hour hearing and 30 boxes of in-camera inspection on what should be transferred or what not, all of which may be moot if, as occurred in this case, the trial judge denies disqualification.
You wouldn't have to go through it unless the trial judge was going to order a disqualification.
So to prevent waiver, you just file the pleading and ask for it, but nobody does anything with it?
No, that's not what I'm saying, and I apologize. I think if there was a disqualification ordered, I think right then you have to go through it.
Well, they moved real quick after the disqualification was ordered, right?
Well, but they never asked for it in the first instance at the trial court.
That's my point. So you just prevent waiver, you just ask for it, but nobody does anything about it until the actual disqualification. It's just a matter of putting that line in the pleading makes the difference.
Well, putting that line in the pleading and alerting everybody. If you're disqualified, and one of the problems I have, if you're
alerting everybody to do what?
To not transfer the information. What if McCool Smith, fearing disqualification, interviewed the top 50 firms in town and showed them the information?
But that's based on your view that when you're disqualified, if you feel like you might be disqualified, it's okay just to transfer everything. You have no duty to say, you know, there might be a problem with us sending some of this to the new firm.
Well, the difference here is in the second disqualification, the one where the court ordered disqualification, Epic and George were very clear. This is a brand new issue and a single rifle shot issue. They disparaged their former firm's work product. They weren't talking about confidences in the new appeal. That's in their petition for mandamus. This is a new and independent ground, very focused. And the court agreed with it.
Let me, just to put a fine point on it, let's assume that they had moved for disqualification in the trial court, and the trial court had granted it. And then at the end of that hearing, when the judge had sent me an order, they said, Your Honor, we're going to be filing a motion tomorrow asking you to order disqualified counsel not to transfer work product. Would you say that they had waived that motion because they didn't include it with their motion to disqualify?
I wouldn't. I think a lot of judges probably would. I think our pleading rules may require.
What's your position here in front of the court? Would it be waived or not?
I personally wouldn't say it was waived.
There was the difference between the situation we have here. The trial court denied the motion to disqualify. It wasn't until we said, yes, they're disqualified, that they would then have the opportunity to come and say, now don't let the disqualified counsel disseminate the documents.
Several. Number one is that there was a long period of time that could have made the problem much worse. I don't know whether he did or not, but he could have made the problem much worse by interviewing these firms and sharing information, because nobody's put on notice that this is what they want to do. And they didn't do this piecemeal because that's the way they had to do it. They did it piecemeal because they didn't know either to do it, or they didn't think they could get away with doing it in the first proceeding. And that's classic waiver.
Is it really?
I think so.
I've always considered that waiver involved an intentional relinquishment. Not a passive relinquishment, but an intentional relinquishment of a known right. Now, from what you're describing to me, that doesn't sound like an intentional relinquishment.
It is, because we're all charged with what the law is. It's not any different, I don't believe, than filing your lawsuit and say, I want a declaratory judgment that so-and-so ran me over. And then after you get that, saying, oh, by the way, now I'm going to sue for damages. We put these things together, and we require people to plead all of their relief on the same facts and circumstances for judicial economy, fairness to the parties, so things don't get stale, so we don't have conflicting rulings. So I think that's a waiver. When I, as a lawyer, don't seek all of the relief that my client is entitled to in a trial, 9 out of 10 times, probably 99 out of 100, I'm going to be in some trouble because my client has waived.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to go back to Justice Baker's question about when did the disqualifying circumstance exist. Remember the basis for the waiver in Epic 1, of the waiver argument. And in Epic 1, what ultimately put us on notice is to get to the trial, and they start attacking their work product, and then we know. But remember that way back when we first moved to disqualify them in Epic 1, and they said, we're not going to attack work product. Remember, they wrote us all those letters and said, don't worry, that's not what we're doing. If at the very beginning of Epic in Matter 2, and we said, wait a minute, these look substantially related, if they had said then, honestly, what they were really going to do, if they had said, well, let me tell you what we're going to do, we got this circle of power, we're going to come in and make this argument, then Judge Tyson presumably would have said what Your Honor said, you're disqualified. But they didn't tell us the truth back in the beginning. That's the only reason that we didn't win the first time, presumably. Because had they admitted that they were going to attack work product, they would have been disqualified from the get-go. And that's why the disqualifying situation here exists from the moment that the blue guys start working on Matter 1. So if you're going to write an opinion that says they can't turn their work product over, it needs to say that they can't turn any of it over, because the disqualifying situation existed the whole time that they worked on Matter 2.
That's kind of circuitous.
Circuitous?
Well, what you just said. Which kind of rule do you want? One that says you can't turn over any, period, regardless, or one that has a cutoff date that's a couple of your cases?
No, I don't want a rule that says that you can't cut off any, period. I'm saying that you say there are here's the rule. You don't turn it over if the basis for the disqualification is a confidence. I'm in that slice of the pie.
Well, but let me answer that. If you have a substantial relationship and former representation, you get an irrebuttable presumption.
Right.
So it's always never going to be turned
over.
Right, but
Judge, there are other bases for disqualification. People could be disqualified.
No, but you argued earlier, if there's a substantial relationship, it follows in every case that you find a substantial relationship,
yes,
if there's a confidence. Did you say that?
If there's that kind of disqualification, yes. And then I would limit it this way. I would say only if the work product was created at the time that the disqualifying situation existed, not the situation where they made the work product.
Let me go back to Rule 109.
Okay.
See if I state it right. The first thing is, you have to be a lawyer who's representing a party now adverse to your former client.
Right.
That's the first thing you find.
Right.
Then you can say, and the reason why you're disqualified when those facts exist is, A, you're disparaging their work product.
Right.
B, you're going to violate 105 and reveal confidences. Or C, it's a substantially related cause.
Exactly.
Those are in the alternative. You don't have to have them all.
Exactly.
That's right.
But you see, the reason that those three things are together in paragraph A of that rule is that they're all basically saying the same thing. 105 is saying if you actually turn over confidence, if there's a threat you're going to turn over confidence, then you can't do it. then the substantial relationship is saying, now look, if you can prove these two things are substantially related, then we're going to, the law is going to come in and say we're going to presume there's a genuine threat. And then the first one that says if you attack work product, that's the subset of the substantial stack. Because see, really, if you're attacking your own work product, it's as if it's the same matter. It doesn't even have to be substantially related. I'm now going back to the same matter.
I understand.
So I just want to
say, so now I'm confused on the rule you propose, because in every case, as soon as you satisfy one of those, your cutoff is going to be whenever that started.
Period. As long as that because of course the three things that you promulgated there are not the only basis for disqualification, but those are bases for disqualification, all of which arise out of concern for confidences. And I'm saying that when that's the basis for disqualification, is concern about confidences, and if the work product was created during a time period when the disqualifying situation existed, and if it doesn't come under what I'm calling this exception category that Wisconsin dissent calls a minuscule chance of containing confidences category, because, see, we realize, our side realizes we have to give him something. He needs something so the litigation can continue. The hard part of this whole case is where do you need something so the litigation can continue. The hard part of this whole case is where do you draw the line? Do you draw the line?
And
as
who
Judge
draws
Rainey?
The line?
I'm sorry?
And who draws the line?
Well,
I understand
Honor,
you want us to draw the line.
We need you to draw a line in a test that the district judges can follow. And there's several ways you could draw it. You could draw it like Judge Rainey suggested by saying, we're going to draw the line on core work product or work product, privileged work product.
That How about would be core one, work product that relates to the particular confidence?
Well, see, now that's your test. I wanted to come to that, Judge O'Neill, because what I think your test suggests is the judge is going to try to figure out whether the documents are infected with the confidence. And the problem with that test is, as Judge Heck pointed out, I'm not supposed to have to divulge what my confidences are. Okay? As Judge Brister pointed out, the only people that are going
to have to indulge what the confidences are, but you can say, here was the danger created in this employment situation.
Right.
And anything that is going to grow out of that employment situation where there could have been a confidence,
right.
I mean, you can give some signals without...
You can give the same signals that you use to figure out whether it's substantially related. But is that going to help a judge, realistically, when he's going through the briefcase to look at each document, is he really going to be able to figure out whether that's imbued with confidences? And remember, as Judge Owen wrote in In Re American Home, I can't pierce the Blue Guide's work product privilege. I'm not going to be able to pierce their work product privilege. So
and how do you mandamus and appeal the trial judge without everybody looking at what
right.
these things
See,
are?
I can't say what the confidences are. The only people that are going to be arguing to the judge about what the confidences are the disqualified lawyers. I can't pierce their work product privilege to argue about it. So how on earth is that rule going to work? And, Your Honors, that's what Judge Castle, the dissenting judge in First Wisconsin, was saying. And the balancing rule that the majority talks about in First Wisconsin has been roundly criticized by the commentators. And his notion that you could do what this notion of opening the briefcase and figuring out whether each one is, that's what's been roundly criticized.
So what test do you want us to apply in this case?
The test is, if you're in this piece of the pie, if it's a kind of disqualification that's based on a risk of confidence, which, as Judge Baker points out, really would be one, two, or three in paragraph A of Rule 109, if it's that kind of disqualification, if the work product was created during the time period when the disqualifying situation existed, which I would say is from the minute a matter of two started, now that's what you and I are discussing, but it would be from the minute matter of two started, and if it is not within this category of documents, and this is the hard part, you've got to write this rule about what are you going to let her have, because you have to let her have something. And the way that the dissent in Judge Castle and the dissent in Wisconsin says is, let's write a rule that says, okay, we're going to give them a minimal amount that they absolutely need to go forward. We're going to give them pleadings and that kind of stuff. And the problem is, I can't make him equal. I mean, Mr. Harnett stands up there and Harnett says, well, it's never going to be fair,
okay,
but we can't make it
here's
equal.
Here's my question. Well, let's assume we write the opinion the way you want.
Okay.
Concerning future cases
right.
involving the red piece of pie.
Yes, sir.
Would that create an obligation in all these future cases that at the same time you file your motion to disqualify, you should also be obligated to file a motion to prevent the turnover of the work product?
All right. I don't think it's waived for the reasons that...
Not now, in the future.
But I think it would be perfectly legitimate for Your Honors to write a rule that says, for purposes of judicial efficiency, we're going to say that in the future, when you want to try to get this disqualification on one of these bases, that you should also, but you see, you don't have to address today the other bases. You can leave the rest of the pie and whether they can get work product from the rest of the
We're
pie.
We're just talking about the red piece of pie.
Right. In the red piece of the pie, you could say, but I do not think it should be waived in this case for all the reasons that have been discussed. that we could go back over.
But you are comfortable with us saying, in future cases, it's okay to require that at the same time you file a motion to disqualify, you must also file a motion to prevent the disclosure of the confidential information.
I guess, Judge, I would really have to think about it, because it really gets to the point of what do I have to foresee? It's like what my co-counsel was saying, what do I have to foresee that might happen? And should I really have to foresee that, okay, after they're disqualified, then they're going to go turn over the work product, and then, as Judge Brister pointed out, are we going to put the trial judges to, okay, let's have this hearing now, let's have this hearing, when we don't know whether they're ultimately going to be disqualified?
Well, doesn't that really beg the question that Judge Evans asked? Wouldn't it follow, if your arguments are valid and the court accepts them, that when disqualified, you can't turn it over? So why shouldn't you ask for it right away and put everybody on notice of what's going on? It also kind of leaves me a little puzzled when you keep saying, well, we just don't know what's going to happen, that you had less than a real strong feeling you were going to win when you filed it, or when that your motion for disqualification was a little shaky or something.
I agree with you. And we did feel that we should win. I mean, you shouldn't mm-hmm. file the motion.
Well, then you should say, let's go for the whole enchilada if we're going to win and put it all in.
I agree with you. But it seems like to me that, as we were talking about earlier, Judge, that you're talking about a knowing, intentional relinquishment of a known right, and to say in this kind of situation that my client...
Well, but Tenet goes a little broader than that, too. I think it also says by your conduct, you can waive things.
Right.
You don't have to stand up to the world and say, right, I know all about this, right, and but I don't want to do it, so I'm waiving it. You don't
but
have
Judge,
to say
am
that.
Am I entitled, and this may be Justice Owens' question, am I entitled to prevent them from turning the work product over unless they're disqualified? Isn't it true that I'm not entitled to it until they're disqualified?
But what if the trial court says that they are disqualified?
Right, but that didn't happen until Your Honors wrote the Now, maybe if I'd won in the trial court, then I should have said, okay, next motion, no work product. But I lost. I lost. And since I lost, it's not something I should have had to complain about until I had something to complain about.
Well, what about then, since you lost the first one before Judge Tyson, the work product that was before that?
That the red guy's work product? The work
well,
product
whether they're in the red or blue suit,
right,
the work
right,
product. Both suits were in there right. when Judge
Your Honor,
Tyson
that,
wrote
that's,
right
I don't want to make a pun, but that's a red herring in this case.
Now,
red,
fess up, you really did want
work product is not what we're talking about. We're talking about the game book that the blue guys are writing. And you made the point yourself, Judge Baker. You can't assume that there's no additional confidences, that all the confidences are just what's in the red guy's work product. And since they're going to get it under Judge Tyson's order, that therefore there's no more concern about confidences. You can't assume that.
My question is, since you lost your first disqualification
right.
motion
right.
in 95.
Right.
And then you proceed for another year before we get to the trial.
Yes,
and you file a second motion.
Yes, sir.
What about the work product that was generated from 95 back to when the suit was filed?
They don't get it, Judge. And they don't get it because...
In other words, you want to say from the day one that any disqualified attorney comes in, no work product produced by those... That attorney and the firm he went with
right.
who are adverse.
Right, because that's when the disqualifying situation exists.
The whole suitcase is closed.
The whole, in this particular case, the whole suitcase. Now, if the blue guys had worked on it and done a lot of work before the red guys got there, then the work that the blue guys did beforehand, I'd give them. That's what the court does in Easy Painter and in the Hallmark case.
Now, we have a little factual problem in that the two firms didn't start on the same day in the litigation. The Kuhl firm and the Pennington firm started at different times.
Right, but remember, there were red guys that went to both of those firms.
I understand. That the red guys affect the whole business.
Yes, sir.
Any other comments?
Thank you.
Could we call this the compulsory ancillary claim?
You got me on that one, Judge. You want to say that the requirement that they move to also keep the work product from going over is compulsory and ancillary and that they had to make it?
Well, we have to give it a name. It's not a compulsory counterclaim. So.
Right, right. I guess I wouldn't say that it's compulsory for the same reason that I said a minute ago, which is I'm not entitled to it until it's
disqualified. If you were disqualified, would you feel a duty not to pass on something that might be confidential?
Oh, you are absolutely right, Your Honor. When we conclude that we can't work on a case, you know, we are very careful about what we let the next lawyers have.
And if your client asked for the file back?
I'm sorry?
If your client says, well, give me my file back, I'll go
okay.
find mine.
Your Honor, that's his argument that Vicki owns the file. And the problem with that is the way that disciplinary rule is written, it's not dealing with disqualifications. It is dealing with withdrawals, and it also talks in the language of that rule about to which the client is entitled. And the reason that Vicki is not entitled to our confidences, I mean, really think about it. The Blue Guys never should have been creating this work product to begin with. They were disqualified. They shouldn't have created it at all. How could you say that write a rule that says Vicki owns it when Vicki lawyers, the Blue Guys, never should have created it because they were disqualified?
Any
I mean,
other
if
questions?
Anybody owns it, I'll be epic.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and the final matters. The marshal will now.